Hello, everyone. That was a pretty good show. Welcome to our show with Suzanne
Suzanne
Purcell and
Purcell and
Jamie Louise
Jamie Louise
Bladel.
Bladel.
We've got a lot of feedback here, Stephen. Go on, guys. I think the feedback's gone. So I have two amazing women here who've managed to juggle complete lives. My youngest sister, I'll introduce first, Jamie Lou, I love you. Yes, I do. I truly do. You dear little creature. I love every feature of Yoodle Doodle Doo, which was
I
our
think the
family
song
feat.
said beautiful creature.
Didn't I say you beautiful creature?
No, you said you dear little creature, but I'm bigger than you now, Jilly.
You beautiful creature. We used to sit her on the front of the tractor and sing that song to her when she was little. Well, Jamie said that. Go on, Jamie. Sorry.
I just said I was very lucky. I won't talk over the top of you. We're sisters. We talk over the top of each other, but I'll do my best to behave.
Don't bother because you won't get a word in edgeways. I'm famous for talking over the top of people, Jamie. Anyway, Jamie said something to me once that stuck in my mind, and she said, "There's two types of people in this world. There's consumers and there's creators." Well, Suzanne Purcell, who is a journalist and an amazing woman who also manages to juggle family and kids. I haven't finished properly introducing you, Jamie, but anyway, she's also a creator, not a consumer. Suzanne, thank you so much for coming on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Absolutely. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Look, you two have so much in common. You both, Jamie's further down the track. She's been juggling business and family. For how long, Jamie?
Well, I turned 50 this year and I had my first child. I got pregnant when I was 25. So, yeah, quarter of a century, I suppose. Lots of gray hairs.
And you can dye them, Jamie. We were having a discussion about this, seeing how Stuart Twemlow said you're very good looking, you don't need any makeup, you just need a facelift. And to
I
dye your
saw
hair.
our aunt on the Gold Coast last week, and she's 80 something, 84 or something. She's got her makeup tattooed on. Maybe you
Oh,
could try
that's
that.
after I get the gel, after the gel lift. Suzanne, you don't have to worry about these things yet.
I stopped dyeing my hair when I realized all of the poisons, and I said, well, there are lots of women who have gray hair or salt and pepper hair, and they look beautiful, and I'll just be one of them. And when we were living and working on an organic farm a couple of years back, I stopped wearing makeup for the same reason because I didn't see the point in wiping lead and mercury all over my lips and then eating that stuff and reapplying all day. And so I go makeup free and hair dye free. And you know what? My husband loves me no matter what. Ladies, your husband will love you no matter what.
It's true. It's very, very true. And Jet, you both have amazing husbands. Jamie, Suzanne has a column that has 2.5 million people. Can you believe it?
That's
Two
a
and a
lot.
half, yeah. The US Independent, and she knows everything about everything to do with politics. Jamie, your mother-in-law, knows everything there is to know about politics too.
Yeah, she was one of the founders of Emily's List, which is a an organization that was promoting women in electable positions, and she was one of the founding members of that, and she's on the Tasmanian Honour Roll, having been one of Tasmania's first female ministers, and she was in Parliament for about 30 years.
And left wing,
Yeah,
very left wing.
she's in the left of the Labor Party.
Anyway, they both reared amazing sons, and one of the other things that you have in common is you're both sort of charismatic women, a very leonine. You both have a lot of Leo in you. Jamie's a dragon, and Suzanne's a snake,
She's
and
talking
I'm
Chinese astrology now. You should know that when she says we're dragons and snakes.
Well, I'm just stupid. Anyway, being dragons and snakes, but the thing is, you've both got extraordinary husbands who've recognized that you are the powerhouses who've really supported you. How's that sort of impacted on your families? Tell me first, Jamie.
Okay, well, my husband's a pig. And I call him,
Is
I call him Pigsy. And if any of those of you who have seen Magic Monkey, you'll know what I mean. He's very sensual and loves to eat. And what the great traits of the those born in the Chinese year of the pig or the boar is that they are very hardworking, but they love to play. They want to have a lot of fun. They're very warm-hearted, very kind people. Can sometimes be a bit stubborn, but basically, very people, into people, and got big, loving, warm hearts. And that certainly describes my husband. Yeah, he's a very loving, warm-hearted man, and he's got a passion for social justice. Probably a little bit engendered by being raised by, a parliamentarian, but also
Single
it's just
mother.
in his nature. Yeah, she
And a
was a single
single
mom. Yeah. But I
mom.
think, I mean, look, all credit to him, really. He's just a good guy. But I mean, not like everybody, we all have our faults and our difficulties that we, what do you call them? That when you talk about disability now, you don't talk about disability, you talk about affliction. We all have afflictions, and it's society that disables. So, he's a human being just like the rest of us. But, he's been very, he's very kind-hearted. I think that's the main thing. Yeah, and a family man.
And he's a playwright.
Oh, and he's
And
brilliant. Yeah, he's very intelligent, and he's a great writer, and he's very funny.
and so the between the
Sorry,
go on,
I also
sorry,
call him
go
the
on.
Corgi because I read somewhere once that there were two methods of parenting. There was the duck method, where you let the kids just follow along, but you head off down the path and you expect the children to follow. Or there's the Kelpie method where you're rounding them up all the time. And I tend to do the duck method, but he's more the Kelpie. And but he doesn't limit that to the children. He does that. He does community development. So he's always, convening groups, and he's a social entrepreneur, really. He gets people together to do good things.
But I had this saying that I said to you and Susan, which was well, Suzanne, behind every great man is a very surprised woman, and behind every great woman is a very surprised man, but a very supportive man. And anyway, and your husband too, Suzanne, is really amazing. David is an extraordinary guy too.
Oh, he really is. He really is amazing. He can write out those complicated mathematical equations that they do on chalkboards, and he understands what he just wrote. And I have no concept of. He teaches himself. When we first got together, he was teaching himself. He went to school to be a mechanic, and he grew up with a chemist and an engineer as a father. Okay, so he taught himself the inner workings of a computer. So when we first got together, I was stepping all over computer parts from the front room to the kitchen. So I remember getting mad at him one day because I stepped on this part and it hurt. I said, "Well, at least tell me what I'm stepping on, if you're going to leave all of this stuff out." So I learned, how simple actually it is. It's just a couple of boxes and a couple of connectors, and really that's all it is. And he taught himself how to use all this different complicated software. He taught himself how to write HTML code and build websites. My husband is brilliant, just naturally brilliant as far as mathematical equations go. And so he computer IT technologies is right up his alley, and our son is identical. Identical. He keeps a journal, and in most of the pages, you'll find blueprints to different things that he wants to build when he grows up. And he takes an Etch-a-Sketch, and he will design the inside of a motor. And it's so detailed looking at this Etch-a-Sketch. And I used an Etch-a-Sketch when I was a kid, and I'm just floored by the way in which his brain works. It's exactly like his father. And I'm really lucky that my husband, because my husband is the backbone of what we do. It's just my husband and I, and he does everything, and I just show up.
Well, this is what I'm impressed about. Like, I mean, you've got this huge following. You've just been on, whose show were you just on a second ago? A minute ago?
I was on Lip T the Lip TV. I did two interviews with Gary Franchi earlier this morning.
And whenever I speak to you, your husband's always in the background, sprouting out extra information as though he's the little sort of resource of all this information. But anyway, so you guys are both very solid families, and that's my sort of point. So today we're going to be talking about parenting, and you are both. Jamie has Kickstart Arts. She's the CEO of a major, major drama company. What would you call your company in Tasmania, in Hobart, Jamie?
Community Cultural Development Company.
Right. And you guys, what do you do?
Who do you want first?
You make films. Well, I want to get into parenting because I know you both have, you know, you, Jamie, tell us, how did you manage to start this huge company in this huge building with how many employees do you have?
It varies from year to year, but it, because of the nature of the work being project based, but it's about 20.
Yeah. 20 people 20, that they.
20 to 25.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet you started, you went to the Victorian College of the Arts and you did, acting there. And we came along and cheered you as usual. And, so did the whole world, and you became a very well-known actress. And then you went to, and then you became a single mum, and then you went, to Hobart with your baby. And then how did you just turn, you know, like what did you do and how did you manage to parent? Cause you've got some pretty well adjusted kids. Who are now, how old are your children, Jamie?
The eldest is 24 and the youngest is 14.
Yeah.
So 24, 20, about to turn 21 and 14. Yeah. Three boys, three young men. Yeah.
Three young men.
Well, I guess, it's an interesting question. I mean, obviously there's two dads. As you said, I came down to Hobart with a baby on my back and everything I owned in a little four-cylinder station wagon, with a baby and a broken heart is what I always say. And I came down here because I think Tasmania is my heartland, and I had a good friend here who said they'd put me up for a couple of weeks and just, you know, not mind if I cried a lot. And while I was here, I got offered, you know, a whole lot of things that weren't opportunities that weren't offered in Melbourne where I'd come from. So I got a job in the State Theatre Company down here, and I got three shows back to back, with an almost 2 year old. I don't know, those with almost 2 year olds and recently dissolved marriages would probably understand how difficult that was. That was, you know, I had to work nights and I had to find nighttime childcare, which is almost non-existent. And I didn't know very many people here. But I got offered a wonderful place in a share house with other single parents who were happy to look after the child at night. I got offered, for the nights when they weren't available, nighttime family daycare, which is unheard of, and it just so happened that they were offering it on the night that I needed it. So there was sort of a lot of, because, you know, they had a doctor who worked shifts and she needed the same night as me, so this family daycare would do Tuesday nights. And then I got so the bottom line was, it was a fair bit of synchronicity in terms of, you know, getting support. At first, and that was how I met Richard. He worked on the first production that I did here, and he's a playwright. And so it took us a little while to get together. But I think the secret to, you know, to building, when you say how did it turn? I don't think it ever turned. I don't even know that it ever will turn. When you work in the arts, it's just always uphill. The resources are scarce, the competition is fierce, and the secret to it really is just put one foot after the other every day, maintain optimistic, as optimistic as you can be, and work on your own sort of inner wisdom and inner courage, and keep your heart wide open, because if you buy into that thing of I must win and I must beat the competition, it eats you up inside and you end up with anxiety, and that can lead to depression. So you just have to be really, it's trust and risk and a heck of a lot of hard work and accepting others into your picture as being, you know, you're part of an ecosystem. You're not just the predator that's there to, you know, to be the top of the food chain. You're part of something bigger than you.
And how did you fit the kids into that?
I've always worked, kids come first, so make sure that if they're not with me, they're with people who are safe, people who are responsible, people who share the same values as me. And that may or may not be, well, I've had no family down here, so that's been either childcare or sharing with my partner. But mainly when they were little, we were both working. So, using childcare was pretty important and finding really good quality childcare. What was the rest of the question? How did I fit the kids in? Oh, well, I've involved them in the work too. So, when my youngest was a baby, my eldest was turning 10. Now, he was a particular kind of boy who really needed a lot of stimulation. He, you know, he's had his IQ tests, it's at the show. He had a few friends that were similar. So I started up a youth theatre company, and we used to do improvisation and creative play workshops every weekend, and we do performances for community, and that sort of that became, central to my work. So where possible, I involve the kids in the work and always take them along to rehearsals. And where that's not possible, and it's less and less possible as a CEO, mainly because the work is much more boring and they just don't want to come, try and just keep in constant contact, I suppose. I've got technology's helpful like that. You've always got your phone in your pocket.
So you've always got your kid in your pocket. So Suzanne was sort of concerned about, like, so we've been, Suzanne, tell the story how you got interested in narcissism and
Well,
Ted Bundy. Yeah, go on.
Ted Bundy? No.
Yeah.
I recently had a, and I will not go into detail, but I recently had a very long, painful, very public encounter with a psychopath. And the being an intellectual, you're kind of, whenever you have a situation or an event in your life, you have to analyze it and understand it and look at all of the options. And so that involves a lot of personal resources and emotional resources and time. And I've been trying to understand how to recognize this. And so obviously psychopaths, narcissist, personality disorder, recognizing that we have a very crazy existence, a very crazy culture, and we're forced to accept as normal very psychotic and sociopathic behavior from each other, through many modes of programming, like television and social interactions. Just to give you an example, when I was a kid, all of the parents would gather around outside and sit in lawn chairs and drink tea while we tore up the front of everybody's house. Now, when I go to the park, I see two types of parents, one that will not let the child go for any reason whatsoever, regardless of age. Or two, their head is buried in a smartphone and they wouldn't even notice if the child was abducted literally in front of their face because they haven't looked up from this phone and they're texting, their thumbs are going, and God knows what's happening to the child. And there's no engagement. And so and then there's this huge boom in the last couple of decades of behavioral disorders with ADHD and ADD just look at the DSM-5. They say that toddlers who throw tantrums have bipolar schizophrenic disorders and should be on Paxil. Okay, but I don't think our children are growing up like we are. And I don't mean that like, duh, everybody knows that. I mean, really sit down and think about it. Think about all the freedoms that you had and think about how your parents used to say, oh, when we were kids, we could do all of these things and you're so oppressed. And it's getting worse with every generation. I was talking with my husband. I said, as oppressed as we are right now, our children in 30 years are going to look back at this and say, those were the good old days. And I'm looking at this 30 years ahead of them saying, these are not the good old days. This is terrible. What is it going to be like 30 years from now? I can't even imagine. And I want my children to be healthy, emotionally. I want them to be healthy skeptics. I want them to question not broadly question authority, because in order to have a civilization, you have to agree to some rules, some boundaries. We don't want each other killing each other. We don't want theft to be okay. We don't want pedophilia to be okay. We don't want violence and rape to be okay. But we have to learn to get along with each other. And so in order to do that, we have to learn to empathize with each other. We have to learn to care about each other. I'm very conscientious about these things because I want my son and my daughter to be better equipped than I was. Not that my mother didn't care, because I was very lucky. My mother was very open. When it was time that she thought we were old enough to where we would be exposed to drugs in school, she sat down with both my brother and I and worked at hospitals. So she got information from doctors in the emergency room and told us exactly what the drugs do, what drugs we might come in contact with. When it came time that we were old enough to possibly be curious about sex, she again sat down with my brother and I and talked with us about it. She always instilled the idea that don't ever do something that you can't undo, like pregnancy or getting arrested and brought home in a squad car or getting suspended from school, because that'll be on your permanent record. So I grew up with this knowledge of knowing what was potential and knowing that I had the self-respect and self-esteem to not come into consequences that I could not undo, that I would have to live with for the rest of my life. So I made better decisions than a lot of my friends did. My friends either dropped out of high school, and I lived in a small farming community, so dropping out of high school just meant you went to go work for your family. It's not like you were going to be destitute, but they didn't feel like they could be anything better than what they had always been. And my mother instilled in me that you, every day is a potential to be somebody else and to be a better version of who you were yesterday. So I'm very conscientious of passing that along to my children, but I see how difficult it is to do that when we live in a society where we have no community, we treat each other like we're criminals and we're terrified of each other. We don't interact with each other. If you say hello to someone, they clutch their bag. If you hold the door open for someone, they give you a dirty look.
Yeah. And you were also saying, Susan and Jamie and I, Jamie's actually got my mum there. Can mum hear at the moment, Jamie?
No, she's still in bed, I think.
Oh,
It's
okay.
very early.
Jamie was saying, we were talking about the importance of, or what it's like when you recognize that you are becoming like your mother and the aspects of your mother that you don't like to become. But anyway, look, I thought Jamie's second son, Hugo, has written a song, and it's on the half hour. And I believe this song called "Don't Let Go," Hugo wrote, Hugo Bladel wrote when he was leaving home, because it came out on Facebook and on YouTube at the time that Hugo left home. So, do you want to play this song now, Stephen, by Hugo Bladel? Jamie, do you want to introduce this song a little bit? It's Hugo's song, "Don't Let Go," and then after this song, we'll talk about how not to be like your mother and what parenting sort of things that you've done, and how to be like your mother, which is, I've got so many wonderful qualities from my mother. Jamie, what do you know about this song, "Just Let Go," by Hugo Bladel?
Okay. Well, Hugo had always had a passion for soccer from the time he was about 6 years old. He wanted to be a professional soccer player. And then he worked very, very hard at that for many, many years, left school early so that he could pursue his soccer dream, went to England, did the trials, did very well, was headed for a professional soccer career. And then he had a big turning point where his best friend's mother died well, of cancer. And he had looked close up at what this career of a what the life of a professional soccer player looked like, and he realized that it wasn't for him, and that life was too short to invest, your whole life in something that's not going to make you happy. And so he changed tack, and he worked very, very hard, and he went and got into a circus course. And he's now doing a degree in circus arts, and he's really passionate about it. It meant that he had to leave home. He had to go and live in a different state. He was 19 years old and never lived away from home, lived in a fairly small place before that. And so this was the song that he wrote as he was processing the experience of being away from home and family and heading off down a very different path to the one he'd always envisaged himself in.
Beautiful. Okay, let's play it, Stephen. This is my nephew and Jamie's son, and the product of being reared in a very creative family, having to leave home and all the rest that Jamie said.
All right, don't forget, we have to mute again.
Okay, thanks, Stephen. So how do you rear a kid like that, Jamie, with so much that was a really hard time for his life, and I think that I don't bother answering that question because I think what I'm really trying to say is that was the age at which your kid was ready to leave home, you know, like Suzanne's children are still at the age where you just think they'll never leave home. And yet that's the extraordinary thing is, you know, they grow up and they do leave home, and we have to have equipped them as adults to cope with their emotions and to be decent. And, you know, there's just so many qualities that Suzanne and I were just talking about, or Suzanne was just saying, you know, that we need to help our children have. What do you ladies have ideas about on how to build self-esteem in children? And, you know, because one minute they're on the breast and the next minute they're leaving home, you know, like it's all so fast.
Well, that's a very complex question, and there's a lot of different layers of answers you can think of for that. So, I mean, I guess one of the things is values, and that's what Suzanne was talking about. So the value, you've got to instill good values. But that's not just about, you know, it's not do as I say, don't do as I do. It's about, you know, continually striving to be somebody who embodies better values yourself. You really do lead by example.
And one of those values is communication too. Like, how important is it to talk with your kids?
Oh God, it's the single most important thing. I read this great book. I wish I could remember the name of the author, but it's Fierce Conversations, Susan someone, and it's her. She proposes that life succeeds or fails one conversation at a time. And it's quite profound if you sort of digest that, because it means that you really pay attention to every conversation you have, and you got to do that with your kids. So, and that's about listening as much as anything else. It's probably more about listening than it is about talking, and about having respect for them as people and for what. You know, and knowing them, you know, listening and hearing them, not projecting too much onto them your own personality, and trying to understand what life might be like from their perspective. And the other thing is about making them feel really secure. That's another thing that I read in a child raising book when my kids were little was, you know, it was a Stephen Bidoff book, I think, and he said he knew this great woman who, whenever she saw a toddler, she'd pick it up, and that's what it should be. It should be the toddler should be struggling to get out of your arms, not begging to be picked up. And that kind of sunk in for me. So, you know, I kept my babies very close when they were little. I carried them around a lot. I breastfed them long, you know, so you got to give them that foundation, and then, you know, a lot of listening, a lot of respect, and I think Suzanne was hinting at too, you know, taking calculated risks. Risk-taking is really important. Let them take those risks and give them a sense of the consequences of the risks that you can't reverse, like drugs. Like my biggest fear for my children has always been drugs and mental illness, drug-induced psychosis. And, you know, fortunately, touch wood, they haven't gone down that path. But that is the biggest danger, I think, for young people in our society at the moment. But and as an antidote for that, what I've put forward is skills. Work on your skills. So, you know, encourage them to learn musical instruments. Encourage them to, you know, find out what their own passion is, what they're really into, and then get really good at it and practice it a lot.
Yeah, that's really true. Well, that's gone. I've just put in the Sorry, I've just got some messages here. That's really true. To build, because skills are in a way, what do you think, Suzanne? Skills are a sort of innate sort of knowings and leanings towards things, aren't they? Like you lean towards something and then you know, you're already seeing the different personalities in your young children and what they're interested in, Suzanne.
Yes, absolutely. And I agree with everything that was just said, because that's exactly how I raised the children. I remember when I was a kid, my mother was very supportive of my interests. When I was really young, like 4 or 5 years old, I wanted to be a paleontologist and then an archaeologist. And she bought me every book she could find on dinosaurs and ancient cultures. And when I was in fourth grade, I wrote a 325-page book and handed it to my fourth grade teacher. And my mother helped me edit the book and spelling and put the book together. She was very supportive of everything that I wanted to do, regardless of whether or not I was trying to figure out a career, but just to figure out who I was and what I was interested in and what I like. And so I do the same thing with my children. My daughter hates coloring, but if you give her a paintbrush and some paper, she will paint amazing pieces. Some of them rival Pollock with watercolors. It's very interesting. My son has always been mathematically and inclined toward engineering and always interested in robotics. So we got him an RC car so that he could learn how to fix it, so that he could understand how engineering works on a simple scale. And I think that in that, my children are learning who they are. And if that changes throughout the course of their young adulthood and their childhood, which it will, that's wonderful, because we get to try new things and we get to have new experiences. I want them to have that, because I had that and it made me who I am today. And so I'm hoping that my children will be brave enough to be who they are instead of adopting whatever label someone's flawed opinion of them may be and then trying to fit within that parameter.
Mm. And that really depends on the parent's self-esteem too, doesn't it? Like, it's really tricky to allow your children, to raise children who... to allow your children to express their natural selves. When their natural selves, you might think that other people don't particularly approve of or endorse.
I've had a lot of that. we're a bit weird. And I used to go to the soccer games, and my son, you know, he loved soccer, so he wanted to be a soccer player, so we were supporting him in that whole concept. And one of the other soccer mums came up to me one day and said, yeah, so what do you think he wants to do for a living? And I said, well, he wants to play soccer. And she said, yeah, but what does he want to do for a living? And I said, soccer. And she goes, no, in the real world. And I said, well, you're talking to an actress here who's married to a playwright. You know, that's soccer's fine. And I've always maintained that if he does whatever it is that he's passionate about, if he's happy and engaged in that, that whether or not that's what he's going to be doing in 30 years doesn't actually matter, because it probably won't be. I mean, even if he did do soccer, it wouldn't be in 30 years because his body wears out. So it's always going to be they say these days we have a checkerboard or a chessboard career path. It's not a linear career path anymore. So one experience gives you a set of skills and understandings that will then, you can build on that to do something that might be quite different. And I don't know anybody really who stays doing the same thing throughout the course of their whole life and their whole career. So it's just about being engaged in what you're doing and happy in that. And if you're not, finding something else. But don't let that scare you from investing yourself fully just because you're not sure where the money's going to come from or how long the idea is going to last.
Hmm. What do you think, Suzanne?
I think our children need to be educated. They need to have their self-esteem boosted. They need to know their self-worth. They need to understand that violence is not an acceptable form of communication in any manifestation of violence, that we need to respect other people, that when we encounter other people, we're encountering a broken version of who they used to be. And we need to have empathy and sympathy toward people, that we need to stand up and say, I understand that you may be hurting, but I don't accept the way you're treating me, and walk away. That to have the self-esteem to not care if someone calls you a name, because if that's not who you are, then they're ignorant in even suggesting that about you. And if they wanted to educate themselves, they could come to you in an adult manner and ask you if that were true. But if they, and at any age, at 2 years old or at 98 years older, or you can't know a person by your perception of what you think that they are. You can only know another person by getting to know them and spending time with them and asking them questions. The same thing about ourselves. We have to get to know ourselves, and we have to find out what we like and what we don't like. And as trivial as it may be that we prefer cheese pizza as opposed to pepperoni pizza, what we do and how we live our lives and the choices we make define who we are. So we need to know what our value system is and the value system of other people, and to know that it's okay to have people around you that are supportive of you, and to push away people that are not. That what you do today is probably not what you're going to do in 10 or 20 or 30 years, and you may go through multiple phases in your life. If you had told me that I would be on the radio writing articles, I would have told you were mad if you'd said that to me a couple of years ago, but this is what I'm doing. Before that, I was a stay-at-home mother. Before that, I was working as a paralegal. Before that, I was working in a bookstore. So I've had many hats, and I've learned so much throughout my life. Life is a journey. Life is going and moving toward a place and becoming a better person so that when you get there, you can accomplish your goal better. It's about setting goals. It's about self-discipline. It's about empathy and sympathy toward each other. If we raise children to be those people, then we will have that society within a generation, no more than two generations. So children are very, very special, and they are priceless. They literally are our future. And we, you know, because of Whitney Houston and because of Ronald Reagan, we sort of scoff at that idea, but that is literally true. Your children will someday be running this country. Your children will someday be working for defense contractors. Your children will someday be running corporations. Your children will someday be sitting on city councils and PTA councils. Your children will be teaching other children. Who are you putting out there into the world?
It's so true. And so it's sort of, this is sort of, we began this conversation by talking about your relationships with your husbands and how supportive they are, and, you know, trying to work out how, you know, to marry those sort of the whole picture of like the relationships with the husbands, the relationships with the children, and then your relationships with work. And it really is interesting how many parts of the whole we have to work on. And it takes so much focus.
Well, you know, I just think we can all get like much too earnest about the whole thing. I mean, we're just people, and we're just muffling through doing our best. And if you give your kids the sense that, you know, the future rests on their shoulders too much for the whole universe, you know, that could cause trouble too. So I think there's, you've got to relax a bit too. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, except, Suzanne's very relaxed. Yeah,
permit people our growth and accept that you know, nobody's perfect, and that we're all on a path, and we're all learning, and we're all, you know, going to make mistakes, and keep that conversation open, and it's fine to stuff up, and in fact, it's really good if you do, because as long as you haven't, you know, killed too many brain cells in the process, you want to take some risks. Because what doesn't kill us or make us, you know,
something else does something else.
Safe, you know, make us stronger. Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's like that thing of when you grow grapes for wine, you have to stress them at a certain point for the fruit, like not by not giving them enough water, for the fruit to really grow bigger and sweeter, because it produces its own sugars. in order to, cope with the stress that it's under. And I think small degrees of stress actually don't hurt us at all.
Well, you know, one thing I learned from my youngest son, Freeman, is the power of telling your own story. And I think from my point of view, I just sort of made so many mistakes in my parenting and did so many things right as well. I think the thing that I did best was, this is hilarious because I don't know if it really is the thing I did best, was carrying them. You know, you were saying how you went to Tasmania with your baby on your back. I think those first few years of carrying your kid everywhere is really, really important. Or at least having them within reach. And then I think what you said, Jamie, about one conversation at a time is a really important thing. And I know you're very intense in communication. Like, you know, you take communication really, really seriously. With my oldest son, because he was a nerd, I couldn't even understand him. Which was always my biggest, it's true, it was my biggest regret with Jarrett because he was always talking about these things I had no idea about. It's really hard when you've got a techno head for a kid and you're almost a complete humanitarian. And that's one thing that's really good, you know, if people maintain their relationships with the father of the child.
I think at the end of the day, it just all comes back to values. Having good values yourself, having values that are, you know, courage, kindness, wisdom, continually working on those in yourself, justice, temperance, all those things that all the great texts over all the centuries have put forward as being the secret to a happy life. You know, you just keep on plugging away at those and, you know, permit people their growth, permit them their mistakes, permit yourself your mistakes, be kind, be patient, be calm, and have a good laugh and don't forget to dance. And if you cry, don't hide it in the other room. Cry out in the open and tell them why you're sad, you know. And if you make a mistake, well, you're human and that gives them permission to make a mistake and not hate themselves for it. No one's going to get it right every time. And I just think that's a really important message for kids because I think the ones that end up being under so much pressure that they think, you know, they have to succeed, they have to achieve, they have to do all these things, they get, you know, that's too much pressure for any human being because we really are a product of so many different causes and conditions coming together at any moment in time and it's continually changing and, you know, we don't know. We think we know, but we're terribly arrogant if we think we know all the answers. None of us knows them all.
That's true.
And all we can do is permit each other our growth.
And Suzanne, you know, when you met that woman in grade four, you know, there's always the importance of other people and we should never underestimate the value that we have on other children's lives in this big human family, you know, like that woman who you met in grade four. Really sort of changed your life, didn't she?
Oh, absolutely. She took me on a special field trip to a young authors convention at the Miami Beach Convention Center. And I got to meet authors of some books that I was reading at the time. And I got to speak to other kids as young as kindergarten all the way to about 18 years old who were doing the same thing I was doing and were interested in the same things I was. And after we were done, she put her hands on my shoulders and got right up in my face and said, don't ever stop writing, no matter what you do. And I did for a time. And looking back on that, I felt like there was a part of me missing. I really enjoy the art of writing. I always have. And I wouldn't have thought about doing that if it wasn't for that teacher and it wasn't for my mother's support. She read everything I wrote. She helped me edit it and put it together and taught me how to do that, taught me how to type without looking down at the keyboard, gave me her first or my first electric typewriter. When I was a kid, I was using the old typewriters, the really old ones. And then she, when she graduated from college, she gave me her electric typewriter and I used that thing to death. And we
Yeah.
need that. We need that stable background, that there is a creative, imaginative, ingenuitive, entrepreneurial part of us, that if we do not foster that, we become drones and we accept less than who we are. But we never get rid of that hole that we never fill. And maybe we have a midlife crisis, and maybe we leave our family, or maybe we just do something absolutely drastic. And all it means is that we didn't get that support for our creative self when we first started to express that part of us. It was buried. We were told that, you never make any money being an artist. We, put down the paintbrush and go learn a skill. And that killed a part of us. But we live with that hole. And if we don't have to create that hole in a person and let that person be a whole person as they go out into the world, that is an amazing creature. They do wonderful, extraordinary things. They change our lives. They cross oceans. They build ships so that we can cross oceans. They build a plane so that we can fly in the sky. They build computers so that we can talk to people we've never met before. Those people are the people who were supported as children and fostered with their creative emotional self. The rest of us just are peons walking around trying to fill the hole in our heart. So I see my children as contributions. So I want them to be the best possible version of themselves that they can be. And because success is 99% failure, we tell ourselves it's like a running joke with my husband and I and the kids, because my husband and I are entrepreneurs. We have a media publishing house that we just incorporated, and we're starting that from the ground up with no funding, by the way, and just the two of us. And we tell our children, well, with every day that you fail, that's a wonderful thing, because that means I'm one step closer to success. So however many failures I have to have, let's get it over with. Let's get it on. Let's go ahead and keep failing over and over again, because then eventually I'm going to succeed, and that day is going to feel so wonderful. And it's the anticipation of getting the reward for working hard, for being true to yourself, for being the most authentic person you can be. To me, is the most wonderful part of being alive, and we need to foster that in each and every one of us.
That's the word, isn't it? That's the big word, is authenticity. And it's something that I think about a lot, being your authentic self. What does it mean, like, we wonder, what does it mean to be authentic?
I think it's that fierce conversation thing. It's trying to identify what's really going on and expressing that, not saying what you think other people want to hear, but saying what rings true for you. Sometimes that means you might challenge the status quo, and so then, you need a few skills in your toolkit to do that without alienating people and keeping the conversation alive. I don't think the conversation actually ever, I do see life as a conversation, it comes back and forth, and nothing's ever really fixed. But as long as you've got that ability to stay connected with others, then the growth can happen. Does that make sense? You have to stay connected. If you put your view so strongly that it alienates others, then that can't be a real truth, because a truth is more encompassing than that. It allows space for multiple truths.
Yeah, and even when you're sitting around crying, which is a very sort of strong opinion, how long does that crying last? You know what I mean? Like, everything changes. That's my point, is like that moment of authentic sort of, this is sort of too much, and then the next minute is, oh, I can cope with this. And, not getting fixed in any particular place, but being flexible, which both of you women must have sort of really mastered. And we're coming to the end of our time now. So is there any, I really wanted people to get to know Suzanne Posel. And I've put the links to her newspapers up there. Stephen Roberts works with her a lot, and she and I have enormous giggles. I thought this show was going to be much funnier than it was, but it wasn't. because I have such laughs with both of you. But it was a very, it's a serious issue. So, you know, we're all in this together. And Suzanne, thank you so much for coming on. And you're going to stay with us now because Stephen Roberts is coming on and you're his favorite person. You truly are. And Jamie, you're my favorite sister.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we're up against it with our sisters sometimes, aren't we? But anyway, it's been good, and it's now time. It has been fun and in its own interesting, more sort of serious way. And so now, Stephen, thank you very much for producing the show, and good night, everyone. I'll see you. I'm going on into the next show with you, Suzanne, but I'll talk to you in the song, Jamie. So thanks, everyone.